Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Uhuru Williams grew up curious about the Black Panther Party. He was born 5 years after its formation, and while his parents seemed to believe in the organization's 10-point program calling for freedom, employment, economic and criminal justice, and an end to police brutality, they were uncomfortable with its association with violence. When Williams got old enough, he started to trace the group's rise and demise himself. But while the stories of leaders like Huey Newton, Eldridge Cleaver, and Bobby Seale were easy to find, as were accounts of Panthers involved in violence, Williams struggled to discover accounts of rank-and-file members who performed much of the organization's community service work, like serving free breakfast for school children, running health clinics and child care centers. Hence his new book, edited with Brian Shee. It's a collection of contemporary photographs and first-person accounts submitted by the foot soldiers of the Black Panther Party, along including a number of women. Uhuru Williams is dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Fairfield University. His new book is called The Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. Uhuru, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you for having me today.
So you share in the book that as a kid, you saw a newspaper clipping with a picture of Erica Huggins, who became a leader of the Black Panther Party first in L.A. and then in New Haven, Connecticut, which was near where you grew up. What do you remember finding so striking about her picture?
She was incredibly beautiful, and I remember the Afro haircut, and I also remember her eyes, which were very, very serious. And I remember asking my mother, and it's funny, so many years later, thinking about that as Brian and I were working on this book, thinking about that photograph and how what an impact that it had on me and as a youth, just wondering what the circumstances were for her to be surrounded by these people and why she was in trouble. That's what struck me as a child.
Hmm. She didn't strike you as scary?
Not at all. In fact, she seemed very familiar in a way that like a family member or an older cousin. And that was what was so intriguing about her and about her story, about that image, is that here were individuals who, for all intents and purposes, looked like people who I knew, but who were fighting for this cause that I didn't quite understand as a young person, but which I came to really appreciate much later on.
As a parent myself, I can imagine your parents struggle to be honest with you and tell you about this group, but it's a lot to process the good and the bad for someone very young.
Absolutely. I think they did the best that they could. But I, you know, as a parent myself, I think about the contemporary moment we're in now and how I seek and try to explain some of the things that we're witnessing across the country to my own children. And really understanding that in the context of a much broader history of resistance in the African-American community and how sometimes that's taken very extreme forms.
Do you see any kind of evolutionary relationship between the Black Panther Party and the Black Lives Matter movement?
There are definitely strong parallels between the Black Panther Party and the Black Lives Matter movement. This summer, for example, when the Black Lives Matter movement put out its platform, its program, it very much resembled many of the issues that the Panthers had tackled back in 1966, 1967, 1968, when they were putting together their own platform and program to deal with what I like to call the 6 degrees of segregation, housing, education, Jim Crow justice, and the other ways that people of color in the United States find themselves disfranchised, disempowered, and really put in positions where they are contesting for first-class citizenship. And so what you see, in addition to the platforms of these two organizations, is a youth activism that is common to both. The Black Panther Party, you know, we're accustomed to thinking about it as an organization that was run by people like Eldridge Cleaver and Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, but students made up the majority of its membership, young people who were committed to social justice, who really wanted to see a change in their community, and who became active as a result. That very much mirrors what we're seeing now with the Black Lives Matter movement. Young people, women and men, who are basically organizing and looking for ways to impact their communities. Focusing on an issue that touches communities of color across the board, police brutality, but then branching out and saying, what are the other ways in which we find people of color limited in the United States? Are we going to address issues of housing, of Jim Crow justice, of inequality, of mass incarceration? And in that sense, there are these very strong parallels between the two.
I was really struck by how not radical a number of the points in the 10-point program sounded. Do you happen to have that in front of you, or can you give us a basic rundown of what the demands were of the Black Panther Party?
I don't have it in front of me right now, but I agree with you in this sense. Sometimes when we look at the Black Panther Party 10-point program, we're expecting it to be revolutionary. And yet, if you look at point number 10, basically what the Panthers do is sum up their demands with the language of Thomas Jefferson from the Declaration of Independence. We want land, housing, justice, peace, freedom. And the things that they're asking for throughout, I wrote a piece for the Organization of American History's Magazine of History a couple years ago, and it was entitled, "Was Thomas Jefferson a Black Panther?" You can imagine some of the mail I got on that, Chris. But it was interesting because I made the case that if you look at the Panthers' political ideology, much of what they articulated, much of what they really argued for, you can find in the thinking of Thomas Jefferson. So the idea, for example, that Jefferson said that you needed a well-informed public to be able to have a thriving democracy and that government should provide for universal education. The Panthers were asking for that. Jefferson said that if you're going to have a system in which you promote the idea of business, then you have to create opportunity for people to have land ownership. The Panthers talked about that. So there are these moments where we can look at the Panthers really as a continuation of this longstanding desire in the United States among people to understand exactly what this democratic process is. What are we trying to perfect? And as we think about American democracy in that context, the Panthers really were an important part of, in the 1960s, of rethinking and reimagining American democracy to include those on the margins.
You note that it's a mistake, and I found this really interesting, to view the Black Panther Party strictly as a response to repression, because even if we recognize that there were sort of multiple reasons that people really stayed committed to the work, you feel like love motivated a lot of people who signed on to the same extent or greater extent than anger.
Absolutely. And we found that across the board. One of the things that it was great working with Brian on this project, because I would get these phone calls from him at all hours where he'd say, "I just finished this interview with this person." And a common theme was what really motivated a lot of these young people was the desire really to serve the people. In 1968, when the Panthers dropped self-defense from their title, and they start this series of community service programs, survival pending revolution, the idea that you would create programs to address the basic needs of peoples and communities in distress. And that included things like their free breakfast program and free health clinics, so on and so forth. A lot of that work was motivated by love, a love of people, a love of community, and really a desire to make the lives of people who shared the same space, who occupied the same space, tolerable. And you see that manifest itself in a number of ways with the party. In Oakland, California, for example, we talk about Black Lives Matter today. One of the first things that the Panthers do, in addition to the armed patrols of police, is start advocating for the installation of traffic lights to protect the lives of young people who had to cross these treacherous streets. And you had these corners in Oakland like you have in other communities, Detroit, Pittsburgh, New Haven, Connecticut, just to name a few, where you'd have this long list of people who have been injured or even killed crossing the street. And here are the Panthers saying, "We'll take that responsibility on. We'll make that an issue." And you have people in this book, Hazel Mack being one of them, who was from a Winston-Salem, North Carolina Panther, who talk about just being motivated by a desire to make the lives of people better. And that grew out of the wellspring of love more than it did out of revolution.
I was really struck by the number of people that you spoke to. It might be all of them who sort of stayed active throughout their entire lives, long after the dissolution of the Black Panther Party itself.
That for me was the best part of this book. And it shows, I think, the reason why this is a wonderful story for young people and why we hope that young activists today will pick this book up and be inspired by the stories that are contained with them. Within is that it shows that really this is a continuing struggle, that this is a long process, that the individuals, the women and men who joined the Black Panther Party, all in some way continue to be active politically today. And that activism doesn't only manifest itself in terms of how they see themselves or define themselves in terms of their own identity, but in terms of their deeper engagement with the community. There's so many educators, so many people involved in community service projects that try to bring literacy, financial literacy, to communities of color. So many people who continue to be active and involved in dealing with the issue of drugs and mass incarceration. And so for us, it was powerful to see that, because really what it says is that freedom is a constant struggle, and that those committed to social justice like the Panthers were in 1966 have to continue that struggle, even though at times it appears that that work is not being honored or is not having the desired effect. It's not necessarily what happens in the short term, but the long game that matters.
So often the shorthand story of African-American civil rights in this country is really centered on the American South. It's really interesting that the Black Panther Party emerged in the wake of the Great Migration, right? So many Southern Black Americans moved north and west hoping for a warmer reception, and then millions of them were disappointed.
It's a great part of this story, too, because really we don't think about the Black Panther Party as being started by Southern migrants. But Huey Newton and Bobby Seale were both from Oak Grove, Louisiana, and Texas, respectively. So they were Southern migrants. Their families had gone out to California in search of work during the Second World War. And then as a result of the GI Bill, ironically, and the a democratization of education, were able to attend Merritt Junior College, and it's there in a study group that the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense is ultimately born. But the larger issue of really looking at this as a migration story, the idea that people leave the South in the hopes of something better, and as one New Haven Panther, who we didn't include in this volume, said, but I really love the way that he articulated this, you start on one side of the plantation, you go to the other side of the plantation, and you realize the other side is worse than the side that you came from. Hmm. Well, what do you do at that point? You stand and you fight. And they decided that what they would do is stake their claim in northern and western cities. And so everywhere that you see the Panthers establish beachheads, Seattle, for example, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, really vibrant chapter that you have in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. But what you see them doing is saying, we will stand and fight for justice in these communities. And I think it's even more powerful when we consider the Black Panther Party as a repudiation of the idea that segregation was a Southern problem, that racial inequality was a Southern problem. Our entree or understanding of the race riots that begin to overtake the nation in the late 1960s, beginning with Watts in 1965, is one of a narrative of, well, Malcolm X was preaching Black power and northern cities and communities were swept up in that. But in fact, Peniel Joseph argues that the civil rights and Black power movements were parallel movements. There were always people in northern communities who were looking at this differently and saying, we've got to consider other alternatives to surviving America. And the Panthers were one of those alternatives.
What kind of climate did white flight create for Black Americans who moved to those northern and western cities?
It created a climate both of trauma and a limited opportunity, because as whites were leaving the cities, you also had this process of deindustrialization that's taking place. So cities that had once been vibrant places of economic opportunity, where one could find a job, that had vibrant downtown areas where one could shop, that had the convenience of school systems that were well-funded, suddenly become these bastions of loss. And in that loss, what you find are African-Americans who are experiencing high levels of joblessness, because those jobs, those factories are no longer there, a lack of opportunity to live in good housing or adequate housing, because most of that is moving out to the suburbs. And then they're also dealing with urban renewal, which in and of itself was a destructive impact. So in places like New Haven, Connecticut, for example, you have large numbers of Southern migrants coming to the city of New Haven, finding diminished social services, and then the city, in hopes of attracting whites back to the inner city, begins to destroy some of the available housing, and that limits schools and cuts jobs even more. So part of what motivates that white flight, this desire to get out of the cities, to escape the influx of large numbers of Black migrants, has this impact of being both detrimental to communities of color, but detrimental to the cities themselves, and ultimately to those that left, the whites that left.
We're speaking this hour with Yehuru Williams. He is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Fairfield University and co-editor, along with Brian Shi, of the new book, The Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open, with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
There were lights and sirens. lines. Gunshots fine, cover your eyes as I describe a scene so violent. Seemed like a bad dream. She laid in the blood puddle, blood bubbled in her chest. Cold air brushed against open flesh, no room to rest. Pain consumed each breath, shot twice with her hands up. Police questioned, but shot before she answered. One panther lost his life, the other ran for his. Scandalous the police were as they kicked and beat her.
That was Common singing, rapping, a song for Asada that was released in 2000. My guest this hour is Yehuru Williams, who is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Fairfield University and co-editor of the new book, The Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. We heard that song, Yehuru, and it was about Asada Shakur, who was shot after being stopped on a New Jersey Turnpike and then charged with the murder of a state trooper. Her story does not remotely end there. To this day, she remains, she has taken asylum in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She has. And in many ways sees herself as a political prisoner, even though she's free in Cuba because she is can't re-enter the United States because of the charges that remain against her, outstanding charges that remain against her. Her story is interesting, though, because we, in writing this book, we had to walk the delicate balance between letting the Panthers speak for themselves and talk about some of the great things that they were able to accomplish at the community level and still recognize that they were revolutionaries and that some of the activities they were engaged in threatened the status quo and resulted in the brutal repression that we find in actions of not just the state police, but local police agencies and even the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
I definitely do not get the sense reading this book that you condone violence. As you said, you also want to sort of celebrate the things that Black Panther Party members did for their communities. What do you say to people, and I'm sure that you've encountered them, who find it impossible to acknowledge that the party did any good because it sometimes acted on its own violent rhetoric?
We encounter that a lot. And part of what I share with people is that ultimately wounds produce narratives. And the Panthers were operating then, and they talk about it as being just as powerful today, with the assumption that in American society, people of color tend to feel marginalized and oppressed. And how do you fight back against that? What do you do, for example, if we look at our own contemporary moment, when you have all these police-involved shootings and no one seems capable of responding in a way that affirms the dignity of Black humanity, of Black life, of the life of Black and brown peoples? And so when left with that choice, people politicize. They take action. And the Panthers chose to pick up the gun in the hopes that by taking a defiant stand against police brutality, they could arrest it. They discovered very quickly that that was a strategy that didn't have long-term viability. And that's why they put those guns down in 68 and moved more toward their community programs. It's not something that most people can understand, because if that's not your experience, if you don't understand the wound, then the narrative doesn't quite match up to their understanding of our relationship to police or the government, so on and so forth. But what I like to remind people is that the Panthers never denied access to any of their programs to anyone in the community. In New Haven, Connecticut, for example, the vast majority of people who took advantage of their Breakfast for Children program were young Puerto Rican children who lived in the city, not just African Americans, but Puerto Ricans. These were programs that were really designed to meet the needs of poor people. The Panthers were tackling poverty as well as racial discrimination and racial injustice. And really, you have to study the history and look at what these men and women did to really appreciate and understand that.
Was that free breakfast program instrumental in convincing the USDA to put free breakfast into American public schools?
Absolutely essential. This is an interesting part of this history. The federal program had started a little before the Panthers program, but the Panthers actually expanded in ways that the federal government may have never imagined. And part of what the Panthers were arguing is that if you want students to come to school and be engaged and ready to learn, you have to make sure that they have a good foundation, and that means proper nutrition. And so here are the Panthers saying, we're not going to wait for the government to bring this program to our community. We're actually going to start these programs. And I think that's the mantra that you find across the board with the Panthers' social programs. It was a repudiation of the idea that communities had to wait for government to respond. If government wasn't going to respond, then the people had a responsibility to do it themselves. I'll give you a very good example of that. In Winston-Salem, North Carolina, they had very poor ambulance service. And Hazel Mack and her comrades there in Winston-Salem said, we need to create a people's ambulance service. How many lives are being lost? How many people are being injured far worse because they're not getting adequate transportation to the hospital. And the Panthers only took donations for that service in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. If you got sick, they actually took you. You know, white people got the ambulance. Black people were driven to the hospital in a hearse.
Hmm.
And here are the Panthers saying, you know, if you weren't sick before you got in that hearse, you certainly would be sick once you laid in the back of a hearse on your way to the hospital. So we're going to take on that responsibility. And I think what's really powerful about both of those examples is that they illustrate the ways in which the Panthers were willing to commit to the idea that they would be part of the solution with or without the government's inclusion. What they would do is activate those networks that they had. So in New Haven, again, they were able to get Yale students to staff their medical clinic. In Seattle, Washington, they were able to get local businesses to contribute to the Breakfast for Children program. And all these were done, again, to engage people in the idea that if you're going to live in this community, you have a responsibility to the people who live here as well.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Tommy in DeSoto. Hi, Tommy.
How you doing this morning?
Very well, thanks.
Do you see any correlation with gun rights now and the gun rights then when the Black Panthers had guns and they violated their rights when Reagan passed the law the following year to ban us, I restricted gun rights to the Panthers, but they used it. Show me the force.
It's a great question, and yes, there's a definite correlation between what happens with the Black Panther Party and in California, it was the law that they had an open carry law, essentially, and that law is changed as a result of the Black Panther Party taking on this idea that you weren't just going to carry a weapon, but you could carry a weapon in defense of one's person. And you were going to do that in a way that was political. So you've got the Attorney General of California in 1968 famously commenting that, you know, the Panthers were one of many organizations at that time that were picking up the gun, but they were doing so in a way that was political. And that was very threatening to the establishment. But it was really the Panthers' politics. It wasn't just the gunplay, but their politics that made that gunplay so threatening to not only the Reagan administration, but ultimately J. Edgar Hoover, the Nixon administration, to American government. The idea that this organization was not only going to talk about inequality, but they were going to actively address that in ways that signaled that they were moving toward what many people believe was going to be a race war or at least a revolution. Now, you have some white students who are attracted to that. So you've got the Peace and Freedom Party, ultimately the Weather Underground or the Students for a Democratic Society, who are attracted to the Panthers precisely for that reason. They believe revolution is necessary and they're willing to pick up the gun as well. But I think the vast majority of Americans were concerned about that. And as the caller points out, in California in particular, the Black Panther Party was an important part of the end of the open carry law in that state. The Mulford Act was passed specifically to deal with what California legislators called the Panther menace.
Do you think white fear of the Black Panthers, whether it was justified on the part of sort of regular people just living their lives or not, had anything to do with the growth of the numbers of weapons that non-Black Americans own today?
I think it was true in the era of the Black Panther Party, and I think it's been true across U.S. history. This is a problem that we see. In fact, the dog whistles that we see coming out of the current political campaign on the right are, in some sense, symptomatic of what we've seen in the past when it comes to African-Americans articulating the concept of armed self-defense against white invasionary violence. And so when we look at the Black Panther Party in that context, certainly what you saw in some communities was a response to the fear that these Panthers were ultimately going to start some type of race war or start some type of violent attack on their communities. The irony is that the Panthers didn't do that at all. What we see is that the Panthers were more involved in their community work, and it was really the police that, in many instances, were responsible for initiating violence with the Panthers. That the Panthers did defend their headquarters. The Panthers certainly did engage in activities that warranted state and local police oversight. So no one denies that the police had a legitimate reason to look into the activities of this organization. The problem that we have, and a number of scholars from Kenneth O'Reilly to Ward Churchill and Jim Vanderwalt have talked about this in their works, it's when the FBI realizes that there's nothing to see, that this organization is actually committed to community service, and they continue to try to find ways to undermine it, that it becomes a violation of the U.S. Constitution and ultimately an act of genocide against the Black Panther Party, an act to destroy this organization.
You found, and I think you just alluded to this, but there were some people who, in fact, joined the Black Panthers because they were drawn to the guns and the uniforms and these expressions of anger. And then they found outlets for that fury in community service.
It was part of the Panthers program, Chris, to actually get people to appreciate that once you came into the party, you had to do the work of the party. And this work wasn't always the most glamorous. It was not gendered work. So if you were a young man coming into the Black Panther Party and you thought you were going to get assigned a firearm and have target practice, you might find yourself making breakfast in the morning for school children. You might find yourself selling the Black Panther Party newspaper. You might find yourself working in one of the health clinics or teaching a political education class. So the idea that people would come in and be part of this kind of paramilitary element in the party is one of those myths that persists. This was an organization that did the majority of its work in community social programs. It's not to deny that there were Panthers who were engaged in and believed in the need for armed revolution. It doesn't deny that at all, but it says that if you look at their party over the broad course of its history, you'll find more free health clinics, you'll find more efforts to, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, for example, you've got Panthers establishing a busing program for the families of people who were incarcerated in Milwaukee to be able to go see their families in prison. They were ultimately more concerned about keeping communities together, not splitting them apart through violence.
Not every Black Panther Party member was, in fact, Black. Can you talk about the relationship that other communities of color, notably people like Latinos and Asian Americans, had to the party's activities and how welcome they were?
Well, it's interesting because we do think of the Black Panther Party as being an organization that was all Black, and yet there were several members, Mike Tagawa, who we talked to in our book, an Asian American who was a member of the Black Panther Party from Seattle. So you do have this spattering of other individuals who are Panthers or are in fact affiliated with the Black Panther Party. But really what the Panthers are able to do is inspire other organizations around the idea that people can organize along common areas. And so you get the Young Lords, a primarily Puerto Rican organization that models itself on the Black Panther Party. You get an organization called the White Patriots, which is basically poor whites suffering from poverty who see the Black Panther program is viable for them, and they organize around those principles. You even have a group called the Gray Panthers, senior citizens, started by Maggie Kuhn, who build a 10-point program and model themselves on the Black Panthers, including communal living and the idea that you needed a more militant approach to dealing with the issues impacting the elderly. So you have both this kind of rainbow radicalism that Jeffrey Agbar, a professor at UConn, talks about in our book, where you have this, you know, broad rainbow of organizations that are organizing around similar issues to the Panthers. But then you have people who literally are just inspired by that organization, who see in its discipline, who see in its political platform opportunity and create their own organizations really modeled on the Panthers themselves.
People like Huey Newton seem not to have been bothered by the party's image as an extremist organization. Were there rank-and-file members who were less enthusiastic about violence as a tool for activism, or was that sort of acceptance that sometimes you might have to defend yourself with physical violence, was that kind of a barrier to entry for people?
Not necessarily a barrier to entry, but something that people would, any new recruit would have to navigate and negotiate. Clearly, the Panthers understood that they had to defend their offices. In Chicago, there was that infamous shootout. It really wasn't a shootout, raid that is conducted by the Chicago Police Department on the headquarters, and the deaths of Panther leaders Fred Hampton and Mark Clark result from that raid. So the Panthers understood even before that point, but certainly after that point, that and that was December of 1969, that literally they were going to be the subject of violent attacks. And so they had to be prepared to deal with that. You had some members who recognized that this was going to be a burden, that this would be difficult for them to do, because even though they supported the party's platform and program, they may not have been as comfortable with firearms. But the understanding was that at some point, if called upon to defend the offices, if to defend the membership, to defend the community, one would have to take on that responsibility. And the caches of weapons that are in Mini Panther headquarters are there precisely for that purpose. That's how the rank and file saw it.
You said earlier that the work of rank and file Panthers that were sort of assigned to tasks was not gendered work. The party did, I don't know if struggle is the right word, but there were rather traditional gender roles expected by many of the male leaders of the party. Am I right about that?
You're absolutely right. And what you have with the rank and file are these negotiations that are taking place with women who join the party who come with the expectation that they're not going to fit into these neat gender roles. The Black Panther Party, like every American institution at its core, is sexist. And you have these paternalistic, male-dominated ideologies that really inform the party. That's American society as a whole. And of course, we would expect to find that replicated in the party itself. But within the party, where you have women who are able to rise to positions of leadership, people like Audrey Dunham, who is the head of the Boston chapter of the Black Panther Party, and ultimately Elaine Brown, who becomes the head of the Black Panther Party in the 1970s in the wake of Huey Newton's temporary departure. Women like Erica Huggins, who we talked to in our book, and women like Hazel Mack, who we talked to in our book, are actually able to shift that work, are actually able to move in the direction of ensuring that people that are coming into the party understand that women have a role, have just as much a stake in this revolution as anyone else, and that the women themselves are not going to passively accept these gendered roles. In that way, the Panthers and the women who are part of the party, and I should mention that most scholars today estimate that the vast majority, a large percentage of the Panthers' 5,000 members were in fact women. So a larger proportion of women who are active members of the party than there are men. Those women helped to push the boundaries in such a way that the work itself became ungendered. So you couldn't come into the party like you could in some other organizations, let's say the Nation of Islam by contrast, and assume that the fact that you were a male entitled you to a certain position. If you came into the party, everybody's preparing breakfast, everybody's selling papers, you're going to do that work.
Uhuru Williams is my guest. He's Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Fairfield University and co-editor, along with Brian Shee, of the new book, The Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter @KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
As real as it seems, the American dream ain't nothing but another calculated scheme to get us locked up, shut up and back in chains, to deny us of the future, rob our name. Kept my history a mystery, but now I see the American dream wasn't meant for me, cause Lady Liberty's a hypocrite, she lied to me. Promised for freedom, education, equality, never gave me nothing but slavery. And now look at how dangerous you made me, calling me a madman, cause I'm strong and bold with this scuffle of knowledge of the lies you told. Promised me emancipation and this new nation, all you ever gave my people was salvation. Fathers of this country never cared for me. They kept my ancestors shackled up in slavery. And Uncle Sam never did a damn thing for me. Sat lying about the facts in my history. So now I'm sitting here mad cause I'm unemployed. But the government's glad cause they enjoy when my people are down so they can screw us around. Time to change the government now. Panther power.
That was Panther Power by Tupac, released in 2000. My guest this hour is Uhuru Williams, who is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Fairfield University and co-editor of the new book, The Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Both the songs that we have played, Uhuru, are, you know, from 16 years ago, but they certainly speak to the fact that even after the group was no longer active, the idea of the Black Panthers has remained a force in this country.
Culturally, they remain very significant. And the what they represent in terms of politics. You mentioned that both those songs are from 16 years ago. There are these moments in our history since the formation of the Black Panther Party when things happen that people are kind of drawn to what the Black Panther Party represented. 16 years ago, we're thinking about James Byrd in Jasper, Texas, and his dragging death that led to all types of organizing and activism across the country. We were looking at, in that period, a number of police killings in New York City that really people were organizing around. We go back to 1989 and we think about Public Enemy and the song Fight the Power. Well, Public Enemy really modeled themselves in very substantive ways. That's the rap group Public Enemy modeled themselves on the Black Panther Party with a reading list in their albums and a security force led by a gentleman named Professor Griff, you know, dressed in paramilitary dress, evocative of the Black Panther Party moment. So I think sometimes, and I think in our own contemporary moment, we're seeing this now, although the original Black Panthers draw a sharp distinction between themselves and the new Black Panther Party, who they say are in no way affiliated or connected. We do see individuals looking at the Black Panther Party as a model of resistance, and we see those reverberations in our music and in our culture in those moments when people say, hey, maybe we need to go back and revisit what they did because we're suffering here and now. Beyonce's Super Bowl performance in the song Formation, with her dancers dressed up in a style evocative of the Black Panthers, symbolizes that moment in our own, this year in our own contemporary moment.
Okay, ladies, now let's get information. Okay, ladies, now let's get information. Prove to me you got some coordination. You just might be a Black Bill Gates in the making.
You know, Uhuru, at the Super Bowl, it was so interesting to see how different the reactions were to that performance, depending in some cases, certainly on race, but also on age and on social class. There were lots of different strong reactions to Beyoncé's performance.
There certainly were. And I think they, in some sense, underscore what was happening in the 1960s as well. You have this older generation of African-Americans who are also concerned about the Black Panther Party and also concerned about what the Black Panther Party means, what it represents. Jackie Robinson, for example, there's a great story that his daughter Sharon Robinson tells about Jack coming home one day and finding a poster of Huey Newton on her wall. And Jack himself had given to the NAACP and been involved with civil rights organizations. And he sees this poster of the Black Panthers on a wall and he orders her immediately to take it down. Hmm. There's this older generation that is just concerned about what this means and who believe that revolution is not the key, that you certainly don't want to alienate others. They are more in line with the message of inclusiveness and racial harmony that we see coming out of the mainstream civil rights movement than what people perceive as the separatist tone coming out of the Black Power movement, of which the Black Panthers become kind of the poster children. There's a problem with that historically because the predominantly white Peace and Freedom Party actually runs Eldridge Cleaver as a candidate for president, as its candidate for president in 1968. And the Panthers had extensive networks and ties and coalitions with whites. So there's this kind of misperception of what that represents, but you still see it today where there's an older generation that looks at displays such as that and questions whether that can do any good in a society where blacks still represent such a small proportion of the population. Are you setting yourself up in that sense to be oppositional with no real hope of success outside coalition building, which sustained the civil rights movement, and some argue is the reason the Black Power movement was so easily suppressed?
All right, let's go back to the phones now. We have Corliss calling from Dallas. Hi, Corliss.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well.
I'm enjoying the show. My comment is actually a bridging of the Black Panther Party back in the 70s when I participated to the Black Lives Movement today. I participated in the community service programs, the free breakfast program, the free clinics, literacy classes, conducted those at the Black Panther Party headquarters in Houston, Texas. I was a student at the time at the University of Houston. But I find myself a little bit fearful when my adult children want to participate in the protest marches and the Black Lives Movement. And it's out of fear for their lives or, you know, if things go badly in one of these protests. But I would like to, for Mr. Williams to speak to the narrative of the bridging of the minds of the two the expansion of the Black Lives Movement into community service programs? Is there any leadership or any indication that this is taking place? Do the young people today understand that Black Lives Matter in our communities? They can participate by doing the things like we did in the 70s, and it's not solely limited to protest marches.
What do you know about that, Yuhuru?
First, thanks for calling in, Sister Corliss. Appreciate that. Yeah, absolutely. I think this generation has a very clear understanding of the importance of community service, although it's not as visible as it was with the Black Panther Party. So you do have Black Lives Matter activists engaged in this type of work. What gets all the media attention is, for example, protesters vowing that they're not going to leave Ferguson in 2014. I happened to be in Ferguson with the National Alliance for Faith and Justice shortly after the killing of Michael Brown. And I remember how important it was for the activists there in saying that we're not going to leave these streets until we believe that some action has been taken. And so the protest marches get a lot of attention. But just like the original Panthers, what's happening on the ground in many communities doesn't really draw as much attention. And so there isn't this pronounced focus on what Black Lives Matter is doing at the community level to address some of these issues. Certainly on college campuses, where the Panthers were also very strong, you have Black Lives Matter addressing these issues. And you do have these young people, and we saw this again this summer in their platform and program, trying to find their way in some sense on how to address this. I think it's interesting, and we talk about this in the book. In 1981, Bobby Seale was invited to Quinnipiac College in Connecticut, and he said to the young people gathered there, if the Black Panther Party had been born in 1981, they would have used computers and not guns. And I think that's interesting because really what we see this generation doing is using the tools at its disposal, social media, to dramatize and to talk about those issues that are impacting communities of color. They're also going to, in their own contemporary moment, find other ways of doing community service that may not be as visible or recognizable to us from a different generation, older generation.
As I understand it, in the 1960s, there was a much lower percentage of Black police officers in this country to white police officers. The ratio was lower. I wonder if the Black Panthers had a position on African-American police officers.
They did. And their position was very different than what you find coming out of organizations like the NAACP, which argued vociferously in many communities that if you had more equitable hiring of Black police and firemen, then what you would ultimately get would be a shift on the police force as you had more officers of color dealing with policing issues and able to really engage in what both vice presidential candidates talked about last night, community policing, because they'd have an actual stake in the community. But what the Panthers argued and what you see in their rhetoric in many instances mirrors more what James Baldwin talked about when he said the only way to police the ghetto is to be oppressive. It doesn't matter who's wearing that uniform. If you're viewing the people that live in that community as somehow being the enemies, if you are pushing controversial or police tactics like stop and frisk, if you are, and we talk about that in our contemporary moment, but the fact of the matter is in Philadelphia, they were doing that in the late 60s and early 70s as a strategy under Rizzo. So the Panthers were saying it really doesn't matter who you put in those uniforms. You're still going to have inequity in the way that those communities are policed. What you need is a holistic approach that looks at what is motivating criminal activity, and then you need to arrest the criminal activity coming from that point. One of the gentlemen we talked to in our book is William B.J. Simmons. And he was a drug dealer in New York City, and the Panthers came across him and drafted him into the party and basically helped him to get off drugs. They said the way that you deal with drug dealers is to try to create programs to help them understand that capitalism press dope equals inequality. What we need to do is to find ways to rehabilitate people, not to warehouse them in maximum security prisons, not to go up and destroy communities, but to find a way to salvage people, to salvage human beings. And a large part of their programs were dedicated to just that enterprise.
We have an email here from Rachel who says, I was fortunate to have a high school history teacher who invited a Black Panther member to come speak with us. It really opened my eyes to the contributions of the party, especially on a local level. Is there an effort to expose students to that same history? And what sort of impact do you think that could have? Rachel wants to know.
What a great question. I think that you find across the board it happening haphazardly. As I talk about in my introductory essay, it was a Panther named Craig Kelly here in Bridgeport, Connecticut, that first opened me, other than the photograph, opened me to the work of the party here. I do think that you have some professors and some teachers who are able to bring Panthers in, but the number of Panthers was relatively small, and you are also dealing with this looming perception of fear that continues to haunt the party, that people really believe that the Black Panther Party was out to destroy the United States. And so in that sense, you will find some resistance among school administrators to this type of activity. It really would take a very progressive person or somebody who really understood the history to recognize that there's tremendous value in bringing in young people. And again, many of the Panthers that we talk about in this book were 16, 17, 18 when they joined the party. To have them come to talk to young people who are around the same age, who are struggling with the same issues, and say, hey, these are the mistakes we made, and here are some of the things that we thought worked, and here are some things to think about as you're trying to figure out where you fit in this critical intersection in our nation's history. I think it would be of tremendous value, and we hope that our book in particular will be a vehicle to help do that.
Why did the Panthers fall apart?
A number of reasons, and we have to point to the federal government and the FBI in particular's campaign of repression against them, the counterintelligence program that started by J. Edgar Hoover. But you also have organizational shortcomings within the party itself. The fact that the party grew far too rapidly and really became a victim of its own growth. You have ideological struggles that split its leadership. You have mismanagement of resources. You have a split between the East Coast and West Coast, which is really exploited by the FBI and further by the FBI. So all the things that we typically see associated with social movements, all the things that typically plague social movements also plague the Black Panther Party. But I don't think that we can emphasize enough the important role that federal repression played in the destruction of the Black Panther Party. The fact of the matter is that without COINTELPRO, there might very well be remnants of the party today. The party survived to 1981 through the Oakland Community School and a relatively small outpost in other communities. But without that federal repression, I imagine that some of the programs that the party created would still be viable today.
Your subtitle calls the revolution unfinished. Can the revolution ever be finished? Is it possible to eliminate the scourge of racism from American culture?
It's a great question, Chris, and I think the Panthers would answer it in this way. I think that they would argue that you never move away from the enterprise that it can be. Christopher Eisgruber, who teaches at Princeton University, famously said, American society aspires to be both democratic and just. And that places a heavy burden on the American people. I think the Panthers were willing to take on that burden in saying that if you're going to profess to have these value systems, if you believe in these core democratic values, you have to make the investment in time. You have to make the investment in energy. You have to make the investment in blood and sweat to make those things a reality. That sometimes means taking the unpopular stand. It might mean, in the case of an athlete like Colin Kaepernick, taking a knee. It might mean, in the case of someone running for elective office, taking a position that's unpopular. But for the rank and file, for the people who live with the daily grind of inequality and poverty in this country, sometimes it has to take more extreme forms. The Panthers were willing to make that sacrifice.
Yehuru Williams is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at Fairfield University, and he's co-editor of the new book, The Black Panthers, Portraits from an Unfinished Revolution. Yehuru, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thanks very much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me again, Chris. Appreciate you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Eric Bright. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Jeremiah Jensen, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.